Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be introducing this episode. So, a few weeks ago, I went to the Unitarian congregation that I attend in rotation with my home ward, and the pastor was talking about the upcoming election, and yeah, none of us knew what was going to happen, but she was trying to prepare us for the worst. She actually got me more freaked out than I already was. And then she said, "The one thing you need to do is to keep coming to church," which is just like a pastor to say, right? But she went on, "We need to be together during times like these. We draw strength from each other." And I realized that she was right. We do need to draw strength from each other. And that's actually one of the things I love most about Sunstone. I've been drawing strength from this community for decades now, whether it's from being together in person at a symposium or working with authors on articles or putting together these little podcasts. Just knowing that you're around really does help. It's kind of like that line from the Heretic movie, where the sister missionary talks about how a study showed that prayer didn't help the recovery rates of subjects in a hospital. I actually thought that there were two parts of that study. The first showed that, yeah, subjects being prayed for didn't improve more than subjects not being prayed for, but that the people who knew they were being prayed for did do better. So maybe the prayers themselves don't help, but knowing that people support you does. And to me, that's what the Sunstone community is. The point is, we know that we care about each other. We meet and we connect. We read and respond to each other. And amazingly enough, that's been going on for 50 years now. We've seen each other through some really hard times. And we're probably going to have to do some more of it in the coming years. Sunstone has always been a labor of love, founded on the many people who have donated and volunteered through the years. Thanks for being part of this community. And if you have a minute, head over to sunstone.org/donate to help keep this work going. And speaking of Heretic, I actually saw it twice in the theaters so far, and I think there's something interesting going on in that movie. I've been pondering on it in my heart, and I'll probably have an episode about it here in the next few weeks, so head to the theaters and watch it so that we can have some nerdy fun together soon, okay? So, as usual, I was looking through old issues of Sunstone, and I stumbled across an article called Four Looks at My Father by Brian Waterman, who was an associate editor of Sunstone during the 1990s, and I wondered what became of him. So I looked him up on Google and found out that not only is Brian a professor of literature at NYU, but that he was also vice provost of NYU Abu Dhabi. One of our Sunstone kids, making good in the world. So let's hear what Brian had to say 25 years ago. 1. I was upstairs asleep that night in 1976, but I can see my father spread like a crucifix on worn orange carpet, thinking he was about to die. I've heard him tell the story, and I remember parts, how he had contracted the mumps from the kids, stayed flat on his back for weeks, and instead of recovering, developed, or intensified, allergies to everything, even the sugar in Campbell's soup. Not that his health was ever great anyway. He'd been raised by a mom whose husband had walked out on her after returning from World War II. A mom who had to be at work before he woke in the mornings, leaving him to a diet of toast and cocoa for his first 6 years. On his mission, somewhere in Guatemala, contaminated Pepsi-Cola ate his insides. By the time the mumps took him down when I was six, he had no immune system, and so I grew up in his world of allergy pills and self-inflicted shots, wormwood teas, and unstable emotions. According to my admittedly imperfect memory, the night he spent sprawled on the living room floor, he made two promises. 1. He would do his home teaching. Because he'd been sick that night, he'd flaked out on his assignments, but he depended on his home teachers to give him a blessing. After that, He was 100%. When I think of Dad's home teaching, I think of hippies. From 1976 on, he'd teach whomever they gave him. And we had whole communes of rebellious bishops' kids living the natural life. Miles out of town, but still within our ward boundaries. He milked the commune goats while my mother helped deliver babies named Wind and Morning. He offered our phone and our faucet when they needed a place to stop in town. Every once in a while, we'd get a van load of messy-haired kids to come in with us to primary. It was a mission of love. His second promise affected me more directly. He's never said so, but I pinpoint that night as the time he decided to give everything to fatherhood. When he saw his 6 short years as a parent spin and rock about to escape him, he reordered whatever priorities there were to reorder and started getting ready for his first Pinewood Derby, his first T-ball game, his first Scout-O-Rama. We were doomed to Super Dad. 2. My first day of first grade at the old Snowflake Elementary School, I walked that 3/4 mile with my dad, since it was his first day there too, if you don't count preparatory faculty meetings. He taught special ed, and so I never expected to have him as a teacher. But I needed him to convince the librarian, Mrs. Switchblade Fingernails, to let me read from the 6th grade shelves. We'd race to school, lamppost to lamppost, past the Pioneer Market, past the old Main Street Chapel, and then he'd head for his classroom and I'd head for mine. By the time I reached 6th grade, though, special ed had sucked his spirit dry. He was in a regular classroom and I was his student. The benefits. 1, he let me run my own student newspaper, courtesy of new Xerox technology. 2, he appointed me class president once. 3, he let me organize a tournament to see who could do a Rubik's Cube the fastest. Of course, he had special Chinese instructions, and I had long since got it under a minute. The disadvantages. 1, he watched to make sure I didn't hold hands with girls during film time. 2, he pulled me out of class one day and bit my head off for publicly humiliating the kid who always made up unbelievable hockey stories for the class's morning news, weather, sports reports. 3, he still wanted to race to school. Or else, when he'd walk, he'd throw his elbows out like a drum major's and imitate a tuba. I had become increasingly aware of other kids walking to school, especially the ones wearing training bras. And I didn't exactly want to be marching with a one-man band. I survived, although perhaps a little traumatized. By the time I was a senior in high school, elementary school had sucked his spirit even drier, and he'd returned to high school teaching, where his career had begun. Somehow, though, he, a political science major, ended up teaching English, since it seems high schools hire only coaches, history minors, in social studies. When he got to teach an advanced government class my senior year, he regained some energy the previous years had drained. I sat back and watched. He read passages aloud from Lord of the Flies, kept kids on edge as flies buzzed around a great big pig head on a stick. He outlined the American political system with verve, making history come alive when he played Jefferson or Hamilton. In May, he scrapped the final exam and had a class mock court instead, much to the administration's displeasure. They took the course away from him the next year. He didn't assign enough homework, they said. When graduation came, though, and the seniors sat at midnight watching slides of school scenes set to sentimental music, his picture came up again and again. His transcendental meditation finger exercises. His rendition of the 60s dance craze, The Vulture. The stance he takes when he can't remember what he was saying. His tie in his mouth, forehead furrowed. The crowd cheered every time his picture took the screen. I realized I had seen a master teacher at work from a higher view than had that 6th grader. A week before my mission, I took him to see Dead Poets Society, thinking his conflicts with the stodgy system mirrored Robin Williams as Dr. Keating. At the movie's end, he cried like a kid, and I half expected him to stand on his seat and shout Whitman's line, "Oh, Captain, my Captain!" 3. Most of my father's books are in his library. Shelves floor to ceiling that made me so proud I once snapped a picture with a Polaroid one-step to immortalize their grandeur. His second library, the family sometimes joked, was the bathroom. Always a stack of half-read paperbacks stood to one side of the toilet or the other, or on top of the tank. His place marks bulged of assorted rainbow card stocks, and he would often yell out to those passing in the hall and make them listen to a potent paragraph. That's what happened the day I became convinced of his apostasy. I, the innocent passerby, was probably 12 or 13, intellectually a lamb. He was reading Christian philosophy, something unsafe, outside channels of real revelation. He said, "Do you think God created the world through evolution?" I stood, drop-jawed, ears unsure. I said, "Evolution?" He said, "I think it makes a lot of sense." And he held the book out to me, spine spread wide to back himself up. He resumed his bathroom business, and I left, stunned, having been forced to think things I'd never thought before. That memory stands out now, signifying irony like a flashing blue light on a Kmart shoe sale. My father's love of knowledge meant this. Family home evening lessons one after another on The Empire Strikes Back, Yoda's Campbellian philosophy dripping heavily off his tongue. Nibbly on the Bantic and the Sophic. An occasional, "So that's what Emerson was getting at with his transparent eyeball." Here's his love of knowledge once removed, manifest in me. My first encounter with Sunstone at 18. Instant identification with a bishop / author who admits he grew up racist. My suspicion as a college sophomore that Nibley's Mantic and Sophic types are structured like any other oppressive binary opposition. My selectively eclectic theology that stretches traditional understanding of prophetic authority beyond orthodox recognition. He says, "Where did I go wrong?" When I came home from my mission, two-thirds of which I spent in bruised-up brownstones in America's inner cities, he told the high councilmen with their slow Arizona drawls, he was glad I'd come to doubt the Democratic Party's approach to social ills. What he didn't realize was that I'd still never vote Republican. At least the Democrats admitted social ills exist. When my wife and I voted for Clinton, and my parents said, "But he supports gay rights!" We said, "Well, why do you think we voted for him?" They're still bemoaning Evan Meekum's railroading, his being tossed out of the governor's office that so many Arizona Mormons had worked hard to get him into. When I was a senior in high school, Meekum came through town campaigning against his impending recall. He spoke in the Snowflake High School auditorium to an audience of saints. My father clapped along as the crowd gave him ovation after ovation. In church, they'd compared him to Joseph Smith. I clapped once when God's little governor said, "We need to be more careful of who we put in office." My father wonders if he should have told me his conversion story one more time, how his parents threw him out when he'd been baptized at 18, how he'd taken a mission on faith and someone's anonymous money, how an apostle had blessed him that his parents would be baptized if he filled a worthy mission. He did, and they were. He gives me a copy of Orson Scott Card's essays, and he writes, "I hope this testimony strengthens yours. He survived his Sunstone phase." 4. As a teenager, I gave my dad an emotional beating. Once, the night before I was to road trip to Puerto Penasco, Mexico, he and my mother barged in on me at a friend's house. Sure, it was 4:30 in the morning, And sure, I should have been home at midnight, but we were doing the long, hot highway to Mexico in the morning, and sleeping was the last thing we were about to do. I argued my point in the family van on the way home, and I don't remember what quite prompted it, but I remember his sharp-tongued, "You're too damn smart for your own good, and your smartness is going to kill you someday." Of course, he came forward with an increase of love. Like clockwork, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, every time. I'd counted on my fingers in my bedroom. 5 years into being a parent myself, I evaluate myself through my childhood memories, sometimes in fear, but more often with a greater compassion for him, a clearer recognition of what went right. Maybe I just could never understand the sickness that had twisted his temper. I certainly didn't understand him the morning we fought over breakfast until I yelled, "You're a fool!" leaving one sister crying at the table, the other kids staring at oatmeal while I slammed the front door behind me. In time, we cleared space for each other, stayed quiet when we knew a few words could set off something bad. He wrote calm letters to me while I served my mission. Occasionally, they would reveal a doubt, a struggle. Why, if he did all he could to live a righteous life, did God keep him from getting well? Like Tevye, he'd shake his fists to the heaven and say, "You're supposed to be bound when I do what you say." Once, in the middle of a humid New Jersey week, I wrote him over lunch, something I'd usually save for a pee day. I gave him scriptures, the outline of a fireside, some popular Mormon self-help tips. But it was timed just right. Inspired. My mother wrote that he'd received the letter while home from lunch on a day he was convinced he couldn't take an afternoon of smart-assed classes. She said he'd cried reading what I'd written. Just those few lines. When I call home, now that they have more kids married than living with them, my mother does most of the talking. She asks me how my daughters are, how Stephanie's job is going. Occasionally, my dad will ask me what I've read recently, but more often, somewhere in the background, my father breathes on a faded extension, static on the line. He stays quiet, and what rides his silence is a love that hasn't quite cast out fear. When I say goodbye, he'll say it back, then leave me on the line with that hard click. I'll bet you have some questions about some of the names that cropped up in this article. I personally was unaware of Evan Meekum until now. I read the Wikipedia article on him, and he was a colorful character. One of the things he did as governor was cancel Arizona's Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which was a paid holiday for state employees. And apparently, in reaction, quote, according to that fount of all knowledge, yea, even Wikipedia, the rap group Public Enemy released a song titled "By the Time I Get to Arizona." And in the video for the song, the group was seen assassinating Meekum by planting a bomb underneath his limousine and detonating it by remote control. The rock band U2, which performed a concert at Arizona State University, publicly announced that they had donated money to Meekum's impeachment campaign and had him denounced from the stage. And that's just one of the nutty things that happened around this guy. And then you're probably wondering about Orson Scott Card. He was indeed one of Sunstone's first editors. He was actually the guy who convinced everyone that Sunstone should be a magazine instead of a journal. And he edited the first magazine format issue, famously called the Rat Issue, because it had an image of a white rat on the front cover. But then he went on to do bigger and better things, like working for the Ensign and writing science fiction novels and other things. So, now you know. Well, thanks for joining me for this episode of the Sunstone Podcast. Don't forget to visit sunstone.org/donate to make your tax-deductible contribution, and I will talk with you again in the next episode.